I think key to understanding the division of the Korean Peninsula is the fact that it all took place in the context of dismantling the Japanese colonial empire. Korea was occupied by Japan in the 1890s and 1890, and from 1910 on was formerly part of the Japanese colonial empire. The division of the peninsula then really goes back to the dismantling of the Japanese colonial empire at the end of World War II. The US and the Soviet Union tentatively divided Korea along the 38th parallel in an attempt to provide a transition from colonial rule to the independence of Korea. But the emergence of Cold War antagonism between the Soviet Union and the US led to a situation whereby the division of Korea, which was supposed to be temporary, became a permanent arrangement. The US installed a regime in the South, a regime of course favorable to its own interests, led by Yi Sing-man, and the Soviet Union did the same with North Korea, where they installed Kim Il-sung as the first North Korean leader. The next major event, of course, is the Korean War, which took place between 1950 and 1953. At the end of the Korean War, the peninsula was divided more or less along the 38th parallel, and what became a provisional division turned into a permanent one. The actual demilitarized zone is 2 kilometers wide on each side, so roughly 4 kilometers, stretching, again roughly, along the 38th parallel. But in effect, the actual demilitarized zone, or rather the militarized zone, starts much further north and further south. There's no civilian population in the stretch, at least going up about 5 to 10 kilometers on each side. So this entire stretch along the 38th parallel is mostly consisting of military installations, guard posts, but above all, a very pristine landscape that is relatively untouched, certainly compared to today's level of industrialization and building. It's a relatively flat area with relatively few trees, so very often you can see actually quite far into the distance. One particular aspect that makes this pristine landscape appealing is its extreme weather conditions. The summers in Korea and in the DMZ are unusually hot and unusually humid, whereas the winters are unusually cold and unusually dry. In the winter, you have grass in essence turning brown, and because it is so dry, there's very little snow. This entire weather pattern, in some sense, goes quite well with the political pattern in Korea, which is equally extreme, with politics on the north and in the south being located pretty much at opposite sides of the political spectrum. Now, one of the most remarkable aspects of the DMZ is that it is undoubtedly the most tightly sealed border in the world, and has been so, in fact, for decades. There's virtually no travel going back and forth between North and South. One of the very, very few exceptions are the members of the Neutral Nations Supervisory Commission where I worked. But in essence, the border is sealed. There's not even any substantive radio or television contacts between North and South. Each side has a different television system. They have installed extensive scrambling devices. And also each side, at least until recently, has imposed harsh penalties for tuning into broadcasts from the other side. In the north, there's virtually no outside information available at all. There's one normal official television and radio station, and the population has virtually no ability to access information from the outside. But even in South Korea, at least until the beginning of the Sunshine Policy, it was not possible to get any information from the north. There was no possibility to get television programs or radio programs, and the regime imposed prison sentences for people who would tune in to shortwave radio broadcasts from the north. Now that has changed in the last few years with the advent of Kim Dae-jung as president and the initiation of the so-called Sunshine Policy, which was extended in some extent with his successor, Nomu-hyung. But still today, North and South Koreans have very little knowledge about how the situation looks like at the other side of the dividing line. Following on from the historical background, one thing I guess that needs to be mentioned are the parties that make up the conflict in Korea, or rather make up sort of the interactions in the demilitarized zone. You have on the one side, on the southern side, the United Nations Command. The UN actually intervened in the Korean War and sent troops, which was one of the very rare instances when the UN during the Cold War actually decided to intervene in a conflict. There are a variety of nations involved in the UN command, but mostly the US. And the US delivered all the substantive troops, and still today the US is the main foreign presence in Korea, or in the South, if you want. But there's a couple of symbolic representatives, say from Canada, France, or so on, but mostly it is US troops. South Korea actually never signed the armistice agreement, but it obviously is present in the negotiations and in the DMZ. On the northern side, you have North Korea and its main ally, China, which intervened in the Korean War. South Korea has, for several decades after the Korean War, was a relatively authoritarian state run by military regimes and characterized by a very close alliance, military and political and economic alliance, with the US. In the last 10 or so years, since the late 1990s, South Korea has embarked on a very successful process of democratization under two presidents, Kim Dae-jung and Nomu-hyung. But at the time I was in Korea in the mid-1980s, Korea was governed by a dictatorial regime led by General Chun Doo-hwan. And in fact, at the time, Kim Dae-jung, the subsequent president, was under house arrest. The North, of course, is one of the most notorious authoritarian regimes in the post-war period, and indeed one of the privileges and one of the most unusual aspects of the position I had was the ability to travel back and forth between North and South Korea, which in many ways was, especially if one did that in a couple of few hours, was almost like traveling in time 50 years backwards and forwards. North Korea is at that point, and still is today, perhaps even more so, an extremely poor country. One of the memories I have is of the building of a road from the DMZ to Kaesong, almost entirely done by people by hand, with one of the few mechanical instruments being used for tanks to broaden the road. The propaganda comes from both sides. Each side broadcasts music or speech for at least several hours a day towards the other side, with the objective, of course, to indoctrinate or to convert soldiers situated at the other side of the DMZ. The propaganda consists mostly of either music or propaganda speech, often broadcast in a very high-pitched, very, very propagandistic type of manner. There are also occasional events when balloons drop propaganda leaflets to the other side, and on numerous occasions we woke up in the Swiss camp with the entire camp being completely covered with propaganda leaflets, and that too from both sides, the North trying to infiltrate the South with propaganda leaflets, but the South as well trying to infiltrate the North. On the southern side, the village of Daesung-dong, so-called Freedom Village, is a small village that is heavily subsidized by the government and is being used really to showcase how successful life in the South is. The northern side has a village as well, as the southern side calls them, propaganda village, and these are really the two only aspects of the DMZ where you have a civilian population under tight control as it is situated. The Neutral Nations Supervisory Commission was created with the armistice in 1953. Its purpose was, in essence, to supervise a particular clause in the armistice that was there to forbid each side to augment its weapons arsenal and its military personnel. So the purpose of the Neutral Nations Supervisory Commission was to make sure that each side would adhere to the basic tenets of the armistice, most particularly to this clause that was forbidding the augmentation of military personnel and military equipment. Neutral, in that sense, formally meant any nation that did not actively participate in the war, but the neutrality of the commission in many ways consisted of the Norse having had the right to choose two nations that are part of that commission, while the South had the equal right to choose two. So while the southern side, the United Nations Command, nominated Switzerland and Sweden, the northern side nominated Czechoslovakia and Poland. So the neutrality of that NNSC, that Neutral Nations Supervisory Commission, consisted really of a balance between two North neutrals and two South neutrals. Initially, the Swiss delegation consisted of about 180 men, which were there, as I've mentioned, with the specific task of supervising that particular clause of the armistice agreement. But of course, the advent of the Cold War pretty much rendered this clause in the armistice illusory, in the sense that each side embarked on an arms race, and the whole notion of being able to control military personnel and military equipment in the DMZ became a farce. With that, in fact, the entire raison d'etre of the Neutral Nations Supervisory Commission was gone as well. So the main task of the NNSC really shifted from this official task of supervising a particular aspect of the clause in the armistice towards a more informal task of constituting one of the few linkages, one of the few guiding links between North and South Korea. Again, at a time when the DMZ was one of the most tightly guarded and then one of the most sealed borders in the world, the NNSC was at least one of the few linkages between North and South. When I arrived in Panmunjom in 1986, the Swiss delegation consisted only of six people, the same with the Swedish delegation. The people who were there was the delegation was led by a two-star general. I probably should say first that all personnel in that NNSC were military personnel, although a lot of Czechs, Swedes, and Poles. In that case, you had mostly professional military personnel, whereas the Swiss delegation consisted mostly of militia people like myself. The head of delegation was a two-star general. The other people involved there were a quartermaster who was responsible for the logistics, a secretary responsible for meetings and the like, a chief of office, which was my position, responsible for the management of the delegation, as well as a camp officer responsible more for food maintenance and the like. The Swiss delegation was physically located very close to the JSA, to the Joint Security Area, approximately 2 or 3 minutes by foot. It was housed in barracks that were established initially in a very provisional manner, but then this provisional manner became more or less permanent. There's two major barracks. One of them is the one in which officers slept and had their offices. There's also a Swiss club, which serves as a location for inviting guests and the like. The Swedish camp was right next to it, and they did in fact share mess hall and the ranger facilities, mostly eating facilities, together with the Swedish delegation. The only formal meeting that took place in the context of work for the Neutral Nations Supervisory Commission were weekly meetings in the JSA, meetings designed to fulfill the formal role of the NNC, that is, supervise the armistice. But as I've mentioned before, this role became completely illusory since neither side had actually adhered to the clauses of the armistice. The more important aspect of the work were of a much more informal nature. It consisted of being a link between the South and the North. So during our weekly formal meetings, we also invited members of both sides to join us, in addition to officers from the Swiss, the Swedish, the Czech, and the Pole delegation. We would always have representatives from the United Nations Command, most notably U.S. and South Korean officers, as well as representatives from North Korea and from China. It is in this context that we try to provide some sort of contribution to conflict resolution on the Korean Peninsula. One of the successes we've had at that time was preparing a relatively informal context within which both sides could talk. Usually the official meetings of the Military Armistice Commission, the MAC Commission, were of an extremely formal nature and were also not very constructive in terms of providing tools for conflict resolution. Most meetings would take place with each side basically coming in, reading out a prepared statement in which they accused the other side of violating the armistice agreement. The situation was formal, was tense, there was press around observing the participants, and that was usually the end of the meeting. There was no talk, no informal talk, there was no attempt to understand the other side, no attempt to communicate. So what we attempted in the context of the Neutral Nations Supervisory Commission was to prepare an atmosphere in which both sides could talk in a more relaxed and a more informal manner. We did that by preparing the meeting at the level of subaltern officers, that is, officers between the rank of about lieutenant and captain or major. And after several months of preparation, we did indeed succeed and managed to hold an informal coffee reception during which North and South Korean and Chinese and American high-ranking officers were able to talk informally with each other. Our activities in the DMC were subsidized by the U.S. government. That is, for instance, we had drivers, U.S. Army drivers, who would drive us around the southern part of the DMZ, and we had South Korean employees as well. The salaries were provided by the Swiss government, but the logistics and training aspect were provided by the United Nations Command, since we were chosen as so-called South neutrals. A regular sort of workday in the DMZ would look like that. It would start on Monday morning and it would go until Friday evening. During the weekend, most members of the delegation were free to travel to Seoul, but at all point, one officer had to be present as a duty officer. So approximately once a month, you were spending the weekend in Panmunjom. Besides regular office work having to do with managing a delegation like that and pursuing a range of activities, we were involved in numerous informal interactions with both sides. That included visits to various government agencies in South Korea, but also visits to North Korea, mostly to Kaesong, a city about 20 to 30 minutes located from the DMZ. Our main points of reference, or our main interlocutors, were, first of all, the remaining members of the Neutral Nations Supervisory Commission, that is, the Swedes, the Czechs, and the Poles. While the Swedes and the Swiss were located in the southern part of the DMZ and were supported, as I've mentioned, by the U.S. and United Nations Command, the Czechs and the Poles were located in and supported by the northern side. There is indeed tourism to the DMZ, and there's tourism from both sides, from the north and from the south. You can arrange a tourist visit to the DMZ from Seoul, for instance. You go to a number of tourist agencies and you can book a one-day trip. I believe it takes about from 10 in the morning to 3 or 4 in the afternoon. A trip to the DMZ that includes a range of aspects, including a visit to Camp Boniface, the major base situated just south of the demilitarized zone, and major U.S. UN command base. It includes a visit to one of the infiltration tunnels, tunnels that were dug by the North Koreans underneath the DMZ with the objective of sending spies to South Korea. And once these tunnels were detected by the South, they really became a major aspect of the Southern's, I guess one could call it propaganda effort to draw attention to the problematic aspects of the Northern regime. The highlight of a tourist trip to the DMZ is undoubtedly the visit to the Joint Security Area. It's characterized by an unusually tense atmosphere and by an ability to see the North Koreans face to face, so to speak. A visit to the DMZ and a visit to the JSA lasts perhaps only about 10-15 minutes. During that time, soldiers come out, they guard the border, and visitors are being shown into the main meeting buildings, the building in which a table cuts across the actual DMZ, and they actually have the physical ability to step across the line for a few meters, entering North Korean territory within the main building that is situated in the Joint Security Area.